He told me he had climbed Stone Mountain on Friday. And you all know how hot it is here recently. I already know that we're in for a special treat from talking to him yesterday, and I would like for you to help me welcome Howard P. from California.
Thank you. That's very nice. Thanks a lot. My name is Howard, and I'm an alcoholic. I could hardly get it up on the platform now after walking up Stone Mountain, but I did it. I did it. Well, I want to thank you for inviting us to come and share in this wonderful roundup. I talked to Marge and George many times over the phone, and we talked on the phone and wrote letters back and forth, and then came and Mike and Sarah have been our hosts, and we've just had a great time. Mike and I have had a growing friendship for a number of years now, and it certainly took a new hold since I've been here. And Lindsay and Richard and David have independently taken us to Stone Mountain and to that Circorama. Anyway, all over. And it's been wonderful, and this conference has been wonderful. And as Dr. Paul said last night, you guys are really special. And it's an honor to be asked, particularly for Sunday morning. And several people have told me that this is the spiritual talk. And I will tell you that this is not as spiritual as the other talks that you've heard. I'll also tell you, and it's just my opinion, that the most spiritual thing we do in Alcoholics Anonymous is laugh. And you guys are very spiritual. See there? See, I start out in my talk and I say two or three things that I think are funny. And if I don't get laughs, we go right to God. Thank you. That was one, and you're doing good. That was one, you're doing good. We're starting now. See, when I look at that, you'll notice when I talk that through my talk, I will from time to time look at my watch. And I don't do that to see what time it is. I do that to let those of you that are worried about whether or not I'm going to stop on time have a sense of optimism. I want you to think that I care. Another thing, in case I know most of you, one of the first things we find out when we come to Alcoholics Anonymous is that speakers, that we're all speakers. Everybody here is an AA speaker, and if you're new, sooner or later, you're gonna be required to speak. And speakers aren't authorities. Speakers share their experience, strength, and hope, their opinions, and I tell you, when I'm doing that, I'll be listening for your laughter. And if I hear it, I'll put it in my heart and I'll take it back to California with me and I'll remember it. But the big book primarily is our authority about alcoholism and about our program of recovery. And I know that. So when I'm speaking, I make up stuff and say that it's in the big book in order to add credibility to my talk. I make up page numbers. I say it says thus and so on page so and so, and nobody ever checks. I hear people say after I get through talking, well, he wasn't much of a speaker, but... They Well, anyway, I wake up in the mornings now, and once I realize it's me, I have a, you know, it takes a little while still for me to know it's me, but when I do, I know that I'm waking up to a good life and that I'm the best person that I've been, and I wake up and feel good about myself and my life. I used to hear in the, and I still hear, if you want what we have. And I wanted, I've always wanted what you had, but I didn't even know what you had. I knew you were sober, and I wanted to be sober, but what has happened over the last years is I have discovered I want what I have. I don't want anybody else's money. I don't want anybody else's wife. I'm just really have a good life. And I feel good about my life, and I'm conscious of the goodness in my life, which is a complete reversal over the way my life was all my life until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. From where I'm at now, I can look back and see that when I was a little kid, there was a lot of goodness in my life, but I never felt it. I always felt bad. On page 45 in the big book, it says, lack of power is our dilemma. And I know that that was true for me in every respect, but most specifically, it was true in my lack of power to feel good, my lack of power to be conscious of goodness in my life. I was either in trouble or I was in a state of low-grade alert that I'm going to be in trouble. I think that today, I think that's just part of what was the seeds for alcoholism for me. It was, you know, we set a thermostat in the room so that when the ambient temperature reaches a particular level, it'll turn on the air conditioning. I have something inside of me, in my nervous system, which turns on anxiety. You know, when the environment reaches a certain level of threat, something turns on anxiousness. My thermostat's off. And I'm anxious when there's not anything to be anxious about. And I'm that way all my life. And I can look back and see that well, I've known my wife and I were kids together. And God, she loved this little town we lived in. And she was happy. I used to think she was the phoniest person in the world because she acted like she liked that place, you know, like her life was fun. And I just couldn't identify with that. I'm a native of Los Angeles, but I was raised in Kansas. My folks were Okies about six times over, and I was raised in this little farm community about 45 miles southwest of Wichita. Now, we all talk about the Bible Belt and where the Bible Belt is, and none of us know. But I know it buckles about 45 miles southwest of Wichita, Kansas. And I started out in the Methodist Church. And I was about 4 or 5 years old in the Methodist Church, and the most important thing in the state of Kansas is the wheat crop. I mean, everything depends on the successful wheat crop. So this Sunday morning, right before harvest started, they would have started harvest today on Sunday, but they don't cut wheat on Sunday. That's God's day to rest. And so they were getting ready to cut wheat on Monday, but in church on Sunday, we prayed for it not to rain so that they could harvest their wheat. Sunday afternoon, it rained. It hailed. The wind blew. It destroyed 80% of the wheat in Sumner County, Kansas. It was really a devastation for those people. And while nobody pointed at me, I knew whose fault it was. I knew who wasn't doing what you had to do to have God answer your prayer. And I figured all these other people were doing the stuff, you know. It was me. Now, if you're 4 or 5 years old and you feel like you have the entire responsibility for wiping out the Kansas wheat crop, you know, you don't feel good. You also have an ego problem, but that... I felt bad about that, you know, and it was a traumatic experience for me. I felt bad about the kind of son I was. My folks were German, and they're not happy-go-lucky Bavarian Germans. I mean, these people were Prussians, and they were disciplined, they were hard workers, they were rigid, and my dad was angry. And he'd whip you. If you did something he didn't want, you know, if he had told you not to do something and you did it, you'd get a whipping. And if you did something he hadn't told you, you'd get a whipping on the theory that, by God, you should have known. Or, by God, you'll know better the next time, you know. And there was 4 or 5 times in my life I was beaten. And it didn't make me an alcoholic, but I never liked it. I understand there's some people that get where they like being beaten, but I'm not one of those. I mean, I'm from California, but I am mostly from the, you know. So I didn't feel good about in my family, and it was great. It was a good family, but I didn't feel good, and I didn't feel good in school. And the fact is, I was 13 years old, and I was delivering papers in this little Kansas town, and just on occasion, I drank a half a pint of bourbon whiskey, and I felt good, you know. All my life, I had had problems, and I felt the problems, and I couldn't do, you know, it was just bad, and now it was good. The problems went away. And it was what I knew when I drank it, and that started to happen. This is what I've wanted all the time. And I tell you, I knew I was going to get that again. It was a spiritual awakening. It really was. In the big book, on page 569, it describes a spiritual awakening. And it says that our feelings and attitudes are altered so that we have a totally different reaction to life. And that's what drinking whiskey did for me. And to prove further that it was a spiritual experience, it also says that this experience is sometimes accompanied by a sudden spectacular upheaval. Mine was every time I drank for a long, long time, I'd get that feeling and then I'd have a sudden spectacular upheaval. I was in the Navy, 17 years old in the Navy. I was running with some guys that they never threw up. I'd say, how do you do that? Well, this guy had a theory. He said people that throw up need to eat 1/4 pound of butter before they go on liberty. He could explain the theory better than I can, but I tried it. I threw up butter just like I threw up booze. Then I asked somebody else, how do you do it? He said, I put bitters. You know, I put 7-Up in with my whiskey, and then I put a dash of bitters. He said, with the bitters, you don't even get the hiccups. I threw up bitters just the way I threw up butter and booze. And you know, it never occurred to me until I was in AA. See, somehow my mind would never let me know that it wasn't the lack of butter or the lack of bitters. It was the booze that was making me throw up. Because booze could never be the problem. Booze had to be the solution. And it was the solution. And I was I was in seventh, eighth grade in this little town. I went to a movie, and they had a short feature before the main feature. And in the main feature, in the short feature, it was about taking domesticated elephants out into the wilderness and rounding up the wild elephants in India, herding them into this huge bamboo-fenced pen. And they took the baby elephants out and they trained them by putting a chain around their right front leg and the other end of the chain around the big tree so that the baby elephant had no chance of getting loose. But it had always gone free with the herd, so it fought the chain and fought the chain and fought the chain and fought the chain until its experience, through its experience, it came to believe that when the chain is tight, it's futile to pull. And it stopped pulling on the chain. And they went ahead with the rest of the elephant's training. But in that movie, they showed the big elephant who was pulling logs, trees, through the woods, how they were harvesting the lumber all day long in order to hold it at night. They put a chain around its right front leg, and they drove a relatively short stake deep enough in the ground and put the chain around the stake. And the big elephant, the chain got tight on the big elephant's leg, and because of the limiting belief that they had imposed on it when it was a baby, its mind wouldn't let it pull against the chain. It was held by the belief. It wasn't held by the chain. And I was in AA about a year, and I heard a story that reminded me of that, and I thought, you know, I came into this outfit with 500,932 baby elephant beliefs, just like that. Stuff that was never true. I didn't even know I knew it. I didn't know I believed it. But I did. And I behaved as if what I believed was the truth. And I didn't know why I was being behaved the way I was being behaved, but I was. And I knew it was. I was in trouble. One of the first baby elephant beliefs I had was, it is important to be right. I feel good if I'm right. I feel better if I'm right. And it became important to me that you know I'm right. More trouble. And then if I found out you believe something different than I believe, it was very important to me that you know you're wrong. And I lived like that, and it was a lot of trouble. Created myself a lot of trouble and didn't know what the hell I was doing or why I was doing that. But between 1950 and 1972, as a result of my drinking, I wrecked 5 cars. One of them was an end-over-end job. I was spending a night in the Sharon Springs, Kansas jail, a weekend in the Dodge City County Jail when I was in the Navy. I spent 11 days in the brig, and I got out. Pat and I got married the month. Pat's my grade school sweetheart. I loved her from the time I first met her, and I've loved her ever since, except for when I hated her. She and I went to the same class of 21 kids. Went to junior high school together and high school, and we got married in 1953, and I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1972. So we were married 19 years with my drinking, and she needed Al-Anon when we were in the seventh grade. And she never heard of Al-Anon until I came to AA, so she was always a problem with the drinking. She was always a drinking problem. But we got married in 53, and we had 3 kids, and I just really, they ended up like fawns in a forest fire, you know. they were just nuts about what in the hell is he going to do next, you know. Now, me, I knew what I did. I went nuts, you know. I ended up going to, I had a nervous breakdown in the 60s, and I went to a therapist, and that was good for me. Well, that therapist saved my life, because after paying him $35 an hour, which is a lot of money, that's still a lot of money to me, but that was a lot of money back then. After paying him for a number of hours, he and I came to the conclusion that my problem was my dad. That was a relief, you know. It could have been me, but it wasn't. It was my dad. I'll drink to that. It was him. And so, boy, I made it through that. My dad had died in 1951. This was the 60s. It's hard to see how he was really my problem, but we saw it. If you pay enough money, you can find that out. And it just went like that, you know. And I'll tell you, between 1950 and 1972 was when booze worked for me. Those things happened when I was having fun and functioning. That was before trouble started. Because in 1962, I got a job as a process analyst, an engineer. And there were things that are required of an engineer that I couldn't do. And somehow I always believed that you had to know what to do. And if you didn't know what to do, you couldn't tell anybody. And so I'd do these analyses, and my boss would talk to me about how it was coming. And he'd say, okay, you're ready. Write the report. What report? How do you write a report, I think, but I don't ask. And knowing I don't know how to write a report or what the hell to put in it, then it's impossible for me to write a report. The fear builds on the fear, and I just grind to a total halt. And now my boss criticizes me because I don't get right reports. And of course, my idea is I'm doing a good job. They're making a big deal out of this when it's not a big deal at all. But he criticized me in my performance evaluation, and I know it was a Wednesday night that I took this stuff home. The reports, it seems like, always have to be done by Friday. You have that report ready for Friday, you know? It was Wednesday, and I didn't even have the report started. And I took it home to work on it. I had never done that before. And I never drank. Mostly I was a beer drinker then, but I had a half a pint of Jim Beam whiskey, and that after dinner I drank about half of that half a pint. And whatever it was that had kept me from knowing how to write reports went away. And I knew what to put, I did. I discovered a technical vocabulary that I didn't know I had. The things to go in the report all at once made sense. And I wrote a report, and I knew it was a good report. And I took it to work, got it typed up, circulated for approval, they approved it. And my boss called me and said, "Did you write that report?" I said, "Yes." He said, "I knew you could do it if you just give me the effort." And I remember thinking, effort? I gave you effort. It wasn't effort, it was drinking whiskey. Drinking whiskey makes me smarter. But I didn't tell him. I knew not to tell him. Because he wasn't going to understand. And they'll never pay you for drinking whiskey, and they'll pay you for effort. And if he thinks it's effort, let him think that. But I knew better. And from then on out, anything that was difficult, I could do better if I drank whiskey, and I knew it. And after a while, I discovered that you don't have to wait till Wednesday evening to start this. You can start it at lunch. Then I discovered that you can start it whenever you want to. It is 4 o'clock in the afternoon someplace. From then I went in the next, actually it was from 1962 to 1969. I went from a process analyst to an engineer to a senior engineer. I moved from General Dynamics in San Diego to Hughes in Culver City as kind of a senior engineer, and then an engineering supervisor. Now that's not setting the world on fire, but you know, that's a series of promotions. And the only reason that I ever got a promotion, the only reason any of that happened, I knew, was because I drank whiskey. And by then, I was also taking bennies. Drink, you know, you get where you have to drink so much whiskey before you get smart that you get sleepy first. And God sent this guy into my life with some bennies. And boy, that was it with me. Bennies helped me in every, bennies and booze. That combination helped me in every area of my life, with the possible exception of controlling my body functions. It didn't help there. And it turned out I needed help. But but you just kind of make trade-offs when you're an engineer. Oh, God, I tell you. But I couldn't, you know, it worked. When I couldn't drink or didn't drink, I tried to stop. I was immobilized. I just couldn't cut it at all. And it never stopped working for me. It stopped working for everybody around me, but it never stopped working for me. I forgot to ask. Frequently I ask when I'm allowed to speak, if will these people be offended if I mention the fact that I took drugs other than alcohol? Now, I'm an alcoholic, and I drank alcohol and only alcohol for a long time before I made this important discovery about Benny. So when I tell, I forgot to ask, so I don't know, but I'd never offend anybody. That's not what we do in AA. But I will tell you, I talk about my drinking for a period of time, and then I got into Benny's. So I start talking a little bit about Benny's. And I wait until about this far into my talk to mention Benny's in deference to Bill Wilson, who waited until page 7 in the big book. To talk about drinking gin with whiskey, talked about drinking gin with sedatives, and then on page 21 in the big book, he says, but what about the real alcoholic? And then he goes on to explain the Dr. and Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and the guy that builds his family's hopes up and then tears them down with the drunk at the wrong time. And then on the next page he says the person finally gets so bad that he takes high-powered sedatives in combination with his alcohol in order to get to work. And then goes to a doctor and gets morphine, for Christ's sake, you know. Boy, I never got that bad. But I'm a real alcoholic. You know, I am a real alcoholic. And alcohol, because I tell you, it worked for me for a long, long time. And then came 1972. And we were talking, some of us got sober in the summer. And I know why they got sober in the summer. Because that was as quick as they could make it after New Year's Eve. I mean, I know, because that was me. And in 1972, it turned on me, and I started having physical problems. My boss demoted me. He was no longer, he took me out of management and said, you've lost credibility with the people that work for you. They put me on special assignment to him. didn't fire me. He just put me up because I could still get things done. It was just that I was now angry as a scalded rattlesnake. He just couldn't be around me. And then I got so drunk one weekend that Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, I didn't have anything, and I was still seeing double. And my right leg would double up on me. Not every time. In fact, not often. But you never knew when. Walking down the hall, face first into the wall, you just do a little pirouette. My son took me to the doctor, and the doctor, who was a lodge brother, and he said, "Well, Howard, do you drink?" I said, "No." And a little bit later, he said, "Well, if you drank, I'd know what was wrong with you." That's not it. A little later, he said, "Are you sure you don't drink?" I called him all kinds of sons of bitches for questioning my integrity, even though I was lying. But on the way home, I knew that that was it. I knew that I'd hurt myself from drinking. It was probably the first time in my life that I saw that booze had caused me a problem rather than being a solution. And I knew that I'd damaged myself, and I knew I might not ever see good again, and that I might not ever walk, and I wasn't going to drink again. But come Friday, I was seeing good, and my right leg was working. Then my boss gave me a difficult assignment. And I didn't realize it at the time, but I had a very special idea come to me. And that idea was, yeah, it caused me problems that weekend, but this time it's going to be different. This time I'm going to drink just enough to get my heart started and get my brain working, and it's going to be good this time. I'm just going to baby it along. It was different that time. I had a convulsive seizure that time. That was different. I'd never had that. I don't know if Paul talked about having a seizure. I will tell you, it doesn't bother you. It didn't bother me much. I kind of have a very rigid and kind of bouncing around there, and I couldn't stop that, but it didn't bother me. But it scares hell out of the rest of the family. They just... Pat didn't call 911, but she called her aunt, who was a nurse, who didn't like me anyway. She said, "Let him die." She didn't say that, but that's what she said. And I couldn't see that this was, I couldn't see how much trouble I was in, because when I didn't drink and use, I couldn't face life at all. And I was hopelessly in debt by this time, and Pat didn't know how badly we were in debt. And I had an opportunity to sell some equipment that I didn't own. Equipment that I found right before the owner lost it. There's this guy I ran with who was a pool shark, and he was also a fence, and he knew he had somebody who wanted to buy some electronic test equipment, and I knew somebody that could find it. And I gave him that test equipment, and that was like on Thursday, and the next Friday, a week later, I haven't gotten any money for this sale yet, and I get my check at work, and I cash the check and give Pat the household budget, and then I take the pittance that's left, and I pay my tab at the Tattletale, and I get drunk. And at lunch, and then I got to go back to work. I missed work so much, I can't miss work anymore, and I'm too drunk to be in there, but I got to go. And I go, and they tell me I'm too drunk, and I get out of there, and I'm drunk Saturday, and, And Sunday morning, I'm in the tattletale. I'm further into the tab than I had been the day before, you know, than I had when I paid it off. And I had no hope of any money. I didn't have a prayer for any money. I wasn't praying then anyway, but I tried to sell some more test equipment direct without anybody involved, you know, just, and I was trying to sell it in the tattletale. They couldn't even keep the TV set tuned in so that you could see it. I don't know what the hell made me think they could use electronic test equipment. I mean, an intelligent person like myself. And the next morning when I woke up, it was a long time before, you know, and I was sick, and I knew who I was, and I knew what I was, and I knew how, I knew I was, all those spatial assignments weren't getting done at work. Nothing was getting done at work. My boss was going to fire me. Pat had gone to see about getting a divorce, and this lawyer said, he sounded like an alcoholic. Why don't you get him to go to AA? And when she came home and told me that, I'd just finished a half a pint. This was a couple months before this. And I just finished a half a pint, so I knew I didn't have a problem with drinking. And but anyway, I was losing her, and I was, and then all at once it dawned on me. 10 days later, and it dawned on me, you know, you shouldn't have said anything in the tattletale about selling them test equipment, because that other equipment that you stole was owned by the federal government. That wasn't Hughes's equipment, and it had not dawned on me till right then. And I knew the routine ends up with agents from the Federal Bureau of Investigation coming around looking for what the hell happened to the government's property. And I just saw what a disgrace I was. You know, I experienced what on page 30 is described as a feeling of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I was a disgrace to myself. I had no intention of ending up like this. And to my kids, who I wanted to respect me, and I wasn't, they couldn't. Hell, they wanted to, and they couldn't. Pat wanted to, and she couldn't. And I just saw the boy, you're facing a hard time in a federal penitentiary. And you're, at best, you'll lose your security clearance. You'll never be able to get in. I've got to stop this drinking until this blows over. I'm going to call Kenny, this guy I used to drink with who disappeared from the tattletale, and we in the tattletale understood that he had become the president of Alcoholics Anonymous worldwide. And I would not have been interested in talking to the vice president. And I called him. At first I thought, I'm going to call him, and that'll help me with Pat. I'm going to stop drinking until this blows over, and I can just go to AA and hide out there. And then I thought, well, I better have a half a pint before I call these guys. And I drank the half a pint, and then I called them, and it was about 10 o'clock in the morning. And he said, are you drinking now? And already being rigorously honest, I said no, because I wasn't. I had finished a half a pint, and I'm not drinking now. He said, try not to drink anymore. He said, if you're too drunk, I can't take you to the meeting. You won't help the meeting, and the meeting won't help you. He said, I'll come and get you at about 7 o'clock. Well, I drank some more, and I took what would today be a lethal dose of Benny's, and so by 6 o'clock, I did not know what the hell I'd called Alcoholics Anonymous for. This, you know, things are not that bad. This is going to be all right, and I hope this guy don't come. But he came driving a pickup truck, which was just what I figured the president of AA would be driving. I got into the truck and I said, I am not an alcoholic. And he smiled. He said, I don't know if you're an alcoholic or not, but I think we're going to the right place. I said, well, don't tell anybody that knows me that you've taken me to an AA meeting. He said, when you called, I wasn't sure who you were, but he said, I remember you. And he said, everybody that I know that knows you knows that your life is screwed up because of your drinking. And I'm going to do everything I can to keep it from them that you may be thinking about getting your act together. I said, I hear you, but don't tell them. And he took me to the Culver City Studio Group, which is my home group. And I was warmly welcomed. Warmly welcomed in a way that I had never been warmly welcomed before. And I was telling each person that I wasn't an alcoholic, and each person was smiling and saying, that's okay, you're in the right place. But there was one guy named Charlie P. And Charlie, when I told him I wasn't an alcoholic, he said, yes, he said, I know. I have a hard time seeing I'm an alcoholic. He said, I'm what they call a slipper. And he said, I slip a lot. And he said, I come to AA, I don't have anything. And I come to AA and I'm always welcome here. And I get sober and I get my life together and I get a place to live and a car and then I slip again. And he said, I really know I'm an alcoholic, but he said, you don't have to think you're an alcoholic. You don't have to say you're an alcoholic to be a member of the Culver City Studio Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. The only requirement for membership here is a desire to stop drinking. And if you have a desire to stop drinking and you'd like to be a member, you're a member. Just having a desire to stop drinking and wanting to be a member makes you a member. He said, there are no other requirements and nobody else gets to think about it. And he said, whether you're here or not, I want you to know that your place is here. Your place will always be here in Alcoholics Anonymous, whether you're here or not. Nobody could take your place here. And that's a tremendous thing for a guy to say to a newcomer. And I felt like maybe I'm in the right place. And you see, when I'm looking today, looking back, that it couldn't have been a bigger miracle, because I had never, ever felt like I was in the right place. Unless it was after about 4 double shots and I was in the tattletale, you know. And I'd think, boy, this is it, you know. But that was, you know, I had that feeling. I never thought about it, but I know I had that feeling. It's also remarkable that I would have that feeling because I was a totally unique newcomer. There'd never been another newcomer like me before I got here, and I've never seen one like me since. And that is, you know, without any reason, without any basis for this to be true, I listened like a person who would listen who thought he already knew it all. Now, there's no reason for me to think that. And if you would have said to me, boy, you really think you know it all, don't you? I would have immediately denied that. I'd have hated you for saying it. I'd have been mad, and I'd said to myself, my problem is I have an inferiority complex. I don't think good enough of myself. That's what my problem is. I don't think I know it all. But I'll tell you, I listened like somebody would who thought they knew it all. And if you said something right, I knew it was right because I already knew it. And if I didn't already knew it, it was wrong. How can you help someone like that? Well, I'm convinced nobody else in the world knows how or could help somebody like that except you. All my life, people had tried to help me, good people, ministers, teachers, the superintendent of schools, my wife. But sooner or later, in order to help me, they had to tell me what was wrong with me. And I can't listen to what's wrong with me. I just didn't have that ability. But I could listen what was wrong with you. and you told me what was wrong with you so beautifully and so honestly. And because you and me are alike, I could see my reflection in your mirror. And it was safe to hear it that way, where I was seeing it myself. But I didn't know that was happening, but that started happening to me right off the bat. Right off the bat, that started happening to me. Although it wasn't easy, because when they read chapter 5, they read the first part of chapter 5, I remember when they read, remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful? I remember the first time I heard them say that, that night. Paul talked about people that remember the first night. I remember that. And I remember thinking, cunning is not an attribute that you can assign to an inanimate substance such as alcohol. Cunning requires intellect. There's no evidence that alcohol has intellect. They've got that wrong. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. God? God? What does God, for somebody that knew it all, I did not know it had anything to do with God. I knew it didn't, or I wouldn't be here. And here it was. But then I thought, they just said alcohol was powerful. And then they say God has all power? Well, now, if God has all power, alcohol can't have power. And if alcohol has power, God does not have all power. He just has all power except what alcohol has. Now, when I'm thinking that, I'm missing stuff that could help me. This is not helping me, what's going on. Boy, this time it's going to be different. This time I'm just going to drink a half a pint. I'm going to take a half a pint and baby it through the day. I am not going to drink more than a half a pint today. I'm just going to drink a half a pint every day, and that's all. Today I'm just going to drink a half a pint. But the half pint's gone at noon, and I'm thinking better. And I know I don't really mean I'm going to drink exactly a half a pint every day. Some days I am not even going to want a full half a pint. Tomorrow, I'm not going to want a full half a pint. I could go out today at lunch and get tomorrow's half a pint. Just take a drink out of it, just one drink out of tomorrow's half a pint, and I won't miss it tomorrow because I won't want the full half a pint tomorrow. And then tomorrow's half a pint's gone by 2 in the afternoon, and then it's a get off my back. I'll drink if I want to. And I would, you know, and my life was slipping away, and I'd wake up the next morning and I'd forget all about that other. It was impossible for me to bring that into my consciousness with any conviction. And today it was going to be different. Today I'm just going to drink a half a pint. But where they let me off the hook was when they talked about a phenomenon of craving. The guy said, alcoholics are obsessed that this time it's going to be different. But once an alcoholic drinks alcohol, they experience a phenomenon of craving for more. Boy, I had never craved a drink. I had never had a craving. I had, when I was a baby elephant, seen the Lost Weekend movie with Ray Milland, you see, and that was a craving. If you've ever seen that movie, that's a craving. And if a guy gets that bad, he's an alcoholic and he ought to go to AA. So I knew, and I told Kenny at the break, I said, I'm not an alcoholic. I said, I identify with part of that, but if craving is what discriminates between the alcoholic and non-alcoholic, I'm not an alcoholic because I never craved a drink. He said, you mean if you drink a half of a half a pint, you wouldn't crave another drink? No, I wouldn't. I'd want one. But I'd just want it, you know, I wouldn't crave it. Kenny said, you know, there's a kind of alcoholic that we haven't described to you yet. A lot of different kinds of alcoholics. And he said, there's a kind that there's a lot of us in the program.
And that's the kind who, when he starts to drink, slugs them down so fast that the craving does not have an opportunity to set in. Now, I identify with that. The second half of the meeting, they talked incessantly, it seemed to me, about God. They read on page 93 that paragraph where it says, emphasize to the newcomer freely the spiritual part of the program. They emphasized that when they talked about God, they talked about their own individual conception of God. And whatever conception the newcomer has, that will work for them, provided it makes sense. And then there was a guy named John. He said, my name is John, I'm an alcoholic. And he said, you know, they call me John the Baptist. He said, Jesus is my higher power. And I, you know, that was all right with me. That didn't offend me. But I wasn't, Jesus was not my higher power, nor was he going to be, you know. And so that way, and then they talked about some guy who had stayed sober for 95 years, and his higher power was a doorknob. You know? Well, that just fit. Some of them said, fake it till you make it. You know, they said they faked it until they make it. You know, and I knew I had faked it and faked it and faked it, and I could never get it to work. And I couldn't act as if. I had acted as if in the Methodist Church, the Baptist, the Quaker, the Catholic. I hadn't faked it in the Unitarian Church, but they don't ask you to. And my mom was a Christian Scientist. There were times when I faked that. And I had just abandoned that. And when I was in college, I had told my sister I was an atheist. And she said, well, that doesn't surprise me. She said, everybody that studies science becomes an atheist. And hell, I wasn't even studying. I just go in school. She said, look at Dr. Einstein. I had no idea that Dr. Einstein was an atheist, but were that true, I did not need a better authority. I'll tell you, it was just me, but I'd pick Einstein over Jerry Falwell's opinion any day. I had never even thought that before, and there I went and said it. I'm getting a little sense of confidence here. I got a little book by Dr. Einstein called The World as I See It, and it's not a technical book, and in the book he describes himself as a deeply religious man. He describes God as he understood him. And I was not an atheist now, you know, whatever it was, which I didn't have any idea what it was, but whatever it was he believed in, I believed in. And just like I tell you, I'll make up stuff and say it's in the big book, I did that with Dr. Einstein. All my life, I make up stuff and say, that's what Dr. Einstein believes. But one of the things he said that I did remember was that he could not conceive of a God with anthropomorphic characteristics, nor could he conceive of a God that rewarded or punished its creatures. Man, that was good news to me. I did not care about rewards. You know, it was not the reward that was worrying me. It was the punishment. And that was good for me. And through that process, you see, because drinking made me feel good, and the stuff that I was doing for God didn't make me feel good. And I don't, you know, I know now I wasn't doing the right stuff, but I just abandoned God in favor of drinking whiskey. And if you're a Methodist or a Baptist, it's awful hard to be both, you know. So I abandoned the one because I could be the other. And I was not interested in God, and I was not going to get back involved in that. I had, to ever what extent, I had sprung the trap. I wasn't going to get my foot caught again. And so I told Kenny after the meeting, I said, I'm an alcoholic, all right, but AA can't help me. And he said, why not? And I said, all that stuff about God, I don't think God changes things. And when I was in college, we had had a class, and in where we had studied how rain happens. You know, the natural laws, and inherent in these laws is apparently unlimited intelligence and power, so that it rains exactly in accordance with the requirements of the law. And I saw no room where prayer would result in some supernatural power interfering with those natural processes, nor did I see the need to. And I told Kenny, I said, I don't, God doesn't change things. I said, I'm not an atheist, but God doesn't change things to help people. God is a mutable law. And he said, hey, that's terrific. You're going to be able to help me with God. But can you not drink? I said, yes, I cannot drink. And he said, well, don't. Can you not take Benny's? I hadn't even told him I took Benny's. I don't know how he knew, unless he noticed I said the same things over and over again real fast. And might have noticed my tongue was blistered from rubbing on the back of my teeth. He said, I'll tell you how it's worked for me. He said, within the next month, I will celebrate my 8th year of sobriety. And he said a lot of the things, because I told him I wasn't going to do any of the steps. And he said, I shouldn't tell a newcomer this, but he said, I really have a good life, and I've been sober wonderfully for 8 years. And he said, I haven't done that 4th step yet. He said, I'm going to do it, but I haven't done it yet. But he said, what it worked, he said, I don't drink no matter what. I just don't drink, just don't take Benny's, no matter what. And I go to meetings. And he said, people will describe something they're doing that doesn't make sense to me. I've learned to say, well, I'm glad they have that. I'm glad that works for them. But I'm not going to do that. That don't fit me. But he said, sometimes frequently they describe problems that I know I have, and they describe solutions to those problems that I know would work for me if I'd do them. And he said, I try to do them, and I don't do it good, but I just plod away at this. And he said, my life is getting better. And he said, I'm grateful to God for this. He said, I think this is God, and my life is changing, and it's changed, you know. Now, he, just like you, you know, he never invalidated anything I said. Sometimes I hear people talk about old-timers telling newcomers to sit down, shut up, and listen. I have never heard an old-timer say that. Not to me. There was a gal that had 2 weeks on me. She used to say it all the time. I've never been invalidated in AA. And nobody's told me what's wrong with me. They've told me what your life used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now, and I learned from that. And I got drunk one more time after. One other thing Kenny said was, when you got in my truck to come to the meeting, the first thing you said was, you are not an alcoholic. And when you got in the truck to go home, the first thing you said is, you are an alcoholic, but there's nothing in the steps you're going to do. And he said, there's no way for you to know it, but if you fully concede to your innermost self that you're an alcoholic, or if you're willing to, that is our first step of recovery. That's the first step of the first step. And he said, it's already happened to you. And he said, that's the way it happens. He said, that's the way it's happened for me. I learn stuff, I change, and I don't even know I've changed. So let's just give it a shot. Yeah, go 30 days. 30 meetings in 30 days. And I got drunk again, and then I came back. And I came back with that feeling that I was in the right place. And I'll tell you, every day of my life was anxiety-ridden. I was immobilized with fear. I was as angry as a scalded rattlesnake. And I'd show up in an AA meeting, and I'd be warmly welcomed. And I would get some laughs. I was one of the most fortunate people in that, in my home group. There was a great speaker meeting. And we also had a beginner's meeting in the first part of the week. But on Friday, We had a speakers meeting, and we had Dr. Paul, and we had Johnny A., and we had Norm Alpie. Now, of all of them, Norm Alpie was one, because I was born in the San Gabriel Valley, and Norm was born in the San Gabriel Valley, and Norm had fallen in love with this red-headed woman, and I had fallen in love with this red-headed woman, he had been to Balboa Island and gone to the Rendezvous Ballroom and danced to the music of Stan Kenton. And in 1952, I had spent Easter week on Balboa Island and went to the Rendezvous Ballroom and danced to, I think it was Count Basie. It was a black, you know, it was one of the big bands. And this guy, and it was great, you know, it was, and I never forget it. And man, I think I'm just like Norm. You know, God, I'm just like this guy. He got drunk, got in the brig in the Navy, and just one thing after another. And then he ends up, his wife throwing his clothes out. You know, he said those clothes packing alcoholics. He said they're funnier than gun smoke, more interesting than gun smoke. He said the neighbors just stop watching TV and come out and watch something. And I got laughed, you know, and then he showed up in AA, and he said, I learned that, he said, I'm not a giver by nature, I'm a taker. I'm a taker of things and a user of people. I'm a loser. All takers are losers, and you were looking at one right then. And when he said that, I said to myself, that's me. I'm a taker of things and a user of people. I'm a loser. That's why I'm a loser. If Norm would have called me that, I would have hated him. But he didn't. He just told me about him. Then he said he was on the sunny side of the street. He was running a bunch of guys in AA, and they're going to meetings, and they're taking commitments, and they're having fun. And he's going home. He said, my wife is going to be glad to see me. She's my wife, and she's going to be glad to see me. And tomorrow I'm going to take my daughter down to the department store and buy her prom dress and high-heeled shoes so she can go to her prom. And said, I have a bunch of daughters. And he said, every once in a while I walk one of them down the aisle so that they can marry some jackass. And everybody in AA is there, and the tears flow. And I'm telling you, without knowing it, I went home, I knew I was like Norm Alpie. And I knew I was on the sunny side of the street. And I felt good, and I learned more about myself, a taker of things and a user of people. I had to stop that, you know? And in the same time, my boss, my sponsor, I told him about that equipment I stole. And he went to... He tracked the equipment down, went to the guy I'd given it to, and he tracked the equipment down, and then he called me, and I'll try to make a short story. The short version is, Pat and I went and got the money and from the bank, and I bought the equipment back. I'd never gotten any money for it, and I had great thief. Pat and I went to the bank and borrowed the money and took it back to the company I stole it from. I told the guy that was responsible for it, my boss, that I'd stolen it. And he said, don't tell me you stole it. He said, I got to fire you if you stole it. You lose your security clearance if you stole it. Don't say you stole it. I said, well, I stole it. He said, don't say that. The next morning, he called me in at the crack of dawn and said, you know, that equipment you said you stole, I put it into the calibration lab yesterday, and it's in perfect working order. There's nothing wrong with that equipment. It's just like new. And while I don't know where it's been over the last several weeks, if you would have stolen it, I wouldn't have it. And I have it. So don't tell anybody that you stole it. And I haven't. Except any of you guys that would listen. Because the next day, when I woke up, and I realized who it was, the first thing that came in my mind was, the equipment deal is over and I'm free of it. And I felt good. I had never, I don't believe, you know, maybe I've conned myself into it, but I believe I had never felt good like that in my life without drinking. And it was a good feeling. And I somehow savored it, and I know why I did, because Norm said, if it's good, soak that up, because it's going to get salty in a little while, you know. And I was trying to do what that, you know. And And it indelibly embedded itself in my memory, the goodness of that feeling, because for 22 years now, I've always known with certainty that I had that good feeling. The good feeling didn't last 15 minutes, 45 at the most. But my conviction and memory of it has always been there. And I just started making amends. I worked the first step and the 12th step, and I was working the 9th step, and things are getting better, but life was tough. And I was mowing the lawn, and I hit a tree root, and I hit my chest on the, I hit my chest on the bolt and the hand that held the handle on. And it hurt like hell. I mean, it was excruciating. And I immediately said, "God damn her anyway." That was Pat. She wasn't even there. Then I said, "And damn AA too. AA don't work." Would my chest hurt if AA worked? No. AA don't work. I'm not going to those meetings anymore and grin like a baboon and say, "Isn't this wonderful? This is not wonderful." I'm not going to drink, but I am not going to any more of those meetings. And I went that night. I had forgotten that I wasn't going to go. I always went with this guy, and he came and got me, and I went. Halfway to Malibu, I was grinning like a baboon saying, "Isn't this wonderful?" Because it was wonderful. The speaker that night was a guy named Don G, who, if you guys haven't had him, you ought to have him sometime. Oh, you know, because he sure as hell changed my life. But that night, Don was the speaker, and he gave a tremendous talk, as he always does. But in his talk, he said, "If you're new in AA and you're not working the steps, AA will stop being fun for you, and you'll decide it isn't going to work, and you're not going to go to those meetings anymore. You're not going to drink, but you're not going to go to those meetings." He said, "You do that for a while, and you'll go to the bar and you'll order a drink. And if you do that, and the bartender says, 'What's the matter? I thought you was going to AA. Don't AA work?'" He said, "If you're not working the steps, be honest with him and tell him you don't know if AA works or not because you didn't try." There was... All my life and my life in AA up till then, people would say something and my mind would pop off and invalidate it. But nothing, I just knew that what Don said was right. And I made a commitment to work in the steps. And I came to believe that there's something in AA, that AA has something. And I'm going to work the steps to see what it was. And I have no idea what that is. But one of them is, I found out my dad is not my problem. My wife is not really my problem. My boss is not my problem. My problem is I'm afraid. My problem is I'm fundamentally fearful. And I couldn't say I was afraid. And when I'm afraid, I'm immobilized. So I have to be angry. I can get strength from anger. So I'm angry, I'm resentful, I'm selfish, and I'm dishonest. That's the problem. I don't have the foggiest notion now about sex. And I don't have the foggiest notion what I'm going to do about this, but I did a 5th step and a 6th step and a 7th step, 8th step, and I'm about halfway through the 9th step. And I come home one day, and Pat said, "Are you going to..." I don't know what night. And she said, "Are you going to a meeting tonight?" I said, "Yeah." I knew she knew I was going to a meeting. So I was in a little state of alert here. And she said, "Well, the kids and I are glad that you're sober." Ha! She's speaking for the whole family, probably with not their permission. And this is a rehearsed talk, I can tell in a minute, you know. "The kids and I are glad that you're sober and we want you to go to meetings, but you know, we need you to help more around the house. We need you to do more things and you're not helping as much as you used to when you was drinking. You're gone more now and we need you more." in the hell are you talking about? I said, why, I listed three or four things that I had done around the house. I presented them as if I had done them recently. And as if these are just samples from a much larger list of things. And she got mad. I found out later her Al-Anon sponsor had helped her work out what she was going to say right up till then. Then she knew what to say. And she said it. You haven't changed at all. You're just like you always were. You're just like you were when, now this is peppered with colorful language. You're just like you were when you asked me if you could quit work and if I go to work and put you through school and instead of your going to class, you went to the Silver Dollar Bar and you drank beer until they gave you a mug with your name on it, which was your only achievement that year. My reaction was a sense of calmness, of understanding, of affection, of knowing, boy, you've done it again. You know, she's right. Hell, I knew I wasn't doing enough around the house, and I felt bad I wasn't, you know. And I wanted to do more, but I wasn't doing more. I wanted to go to meetings and do this other stuff more. And as soon as I get a word in edgewise, I said, Pat, yeah, which wasn't very quick. I said, you're right. I said, you're right. I'm not getting good enough fast enough. And I'll never be able to make up for the stuff I've done to you and what you've done for me. We can never get even. I hope someday you can just forget it and forgive me, because I think that can be the only answer, but I'll try to do better. But I'm going to the damn meeting. When I come home from, I said, we'll talk when I get home from the meeting. I got home from the meeting and she is, you know, hope reigns supreme in the heart of an Al-Anon. And man, I had acknowledged, you know, as far as she was concerned, it was good. I had acknowledged that I needed to change and she hoped I would, and she just kind of forgave me and forget me, you know. And I'll tell you, with Al-Anon, they were able to do stuff that we were never able to do before, and it gave us a good, good marriage. And over the years, so many good things have happened. You know, when I started reacting different, I knew that this program was working. And I would feel good because I was reacting different. And then I'd embed that goodness. I'd let that goodness soak my mind. I started meditating in October. I started when I first came in the program. And I didn't meditate the way it says to meditate on prayer. The way I started out was trying to use the technique Bill described without getting prayer involved in it. And what I did, because this girl that had 2 weeks on me, I heard a guy say he was 36 years in learning that all the people that he hated didn't feel it. Boy, I thought that's something. That's something. The next meeting they said, anybody have a problem they want to discuss? I did. How do you not hate? This girl that had 2 weeks on me used to tell me, sit down, shut up and listen. She said, I just heard that you can't be hateful and grateful at the same time. And if you're a sober alcoholic, you have a basis for gratitude. And I'd tell people I didn't pray. And one guy said, do you meditate? And he said, read chapter 11. And I read 11, and I wasn't going to do any of that stuff. But what I learned to do in times of crisis was to recall as vividly as I could, in detail and honesty, what the last 3 weeks of my life was like when I was drinking. It was hopeless. There was nothing in my life for me to get a toehold, for me to get a handhold to stop the plummeting. I could not face my life. It was so overwhelming. And in order to face it, I had to drink so much that I was just making it worse. And there was no hope. And then I came to AA, and the plummeting stopped.
and I started doing the deal. I took the equipment back. One crisis after another, one threat after another got resolved. And I would know that that was true. And then I'd have a better attitude when I went through the day. And I called that meditation. And in 1974, I made a commitment that I won't miss another day in my life without spending at least 30 minutes in doing that. Now, the things that I am convinced of now that I bring into my consciousness are much better and much stronger. There's a conviction that, as Paul said, and as the big book says, there's an all-powerful, guiding, creative intelligence underlying the material world and my life as I see it. There is no separation. This creative intelligence, this spirit of the universe, underlies the totality of things. That's everything, including the character and quality of my life, including the circumstances and events of my life. And I spend time every morning knowing that that's true, being convinced of that. And then if I'm sure of that at 7 in the morning, I'm sure of it at 7 at night. And it's just been I couldn't have found this any place except in Alcoholics Anonymous. Reading the book on meditation, I've read a lot of them. It said, whatever way you find God, that's the right way. If you think God out and find him, that's right for you. Or if you just feel God, that's right for you. But remember, wherever you see God pass, mark that spot and go sit in that window again. That's here. This is where I came to see God pass. This is my window. I am never more conscious of God in my life than I am when I'm in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and I'm very conscious of it now, and I could never, ever thank you enough for that. I love you.